This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program, Arnold Roth, father of one of the victims of the terror attack on the Sabaro Pizza restaurant in Jerusalem back in 2001, reacts to the news that the BBC Arabic service gave an empathetic platform to one of said convicted terrorists, Alam Tamimi. This week we learn the sad news that the Holocaust survivor Ingrid Wooger has died at the age of 96. We find out about her life and work from Kirsty Robson of Holocaust Memorial Trust. And as York's Jewish community has seen a bit of a resurgence late, we speak to one of the founding members of that community, Ben Rich. But first, it's time for a look through your copy of the Jewish News for this week, and joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and supplements editor Bridget Grant. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Hello, Phil.
Now, let's have a look at the front page for this week, shall we? And the headline reads, "The BBC has lost its moral compass." Oh dear, what have they done now?
Yes, a very troubling front page story this week. The Sabaro restaurant suicide bombing. I'm sure many of us remember a Palestinian terror attack on a pizzeria in Jerusalem back in 2001. 15 people killed, 7 children, a pregnant woman, hundreds injured. The person who masterminded it, arranged the logistics, explosives, drove the bomber to the place where he killed all those people, was a woman, or is a woman, called Alam Tamimi. She only served 10 years in jail. She got off as part of the deal that saw Gilad Shalit freed. She now lives as something of a celebrity in Jordan. She is the opposite of repentant. She's boastful about what she did. You can have a look. There's a video online of her smiling inanely as someone tells her that 8 children died in the bombing attack when she thought it was only 3. She is a monster incarnate. Well, it turns out you and I and every other TV license payer funded BBC Arabic's TV channel to sympathetically interview this woman. She was given a platform to say how she would love to be reunited with her husband after his Jordanian residency was revoked. Her husband, I should add, is also a convicted terrorist who killed an Israeli in 1993. So this week's front page, the BBC has lost its moral compass headline. They're the words of Arnold Roth, whose 15-year-old daughter Malki was one of those that were killed in the attack. The BBC has apologised, but a mistake of this magnitude can it can't easily be forgotten, can it?
Maybe, but I think we should say at this stage, in the absence of somebody from the BBC, that the spokesperson has said that following an editorial review, that they found that the segment was in breach of editorial guidelines, and as a result, they removed the clip across digital platforms last week. Bridget, it doesn't sit very pretty, does it? I mean, even if they have apologised, even if they have recognised it was a terrible mistake, the truth is it happened in the first place.
I've seen a similar story that went out just with BBC Arabic channel on the Sudanese schools and the manacling of the students there, where they're physically beaten. And what they do is anything that they think might sort of steer Islamophobia in a sort of way in this country, they don't show here. I have done a lot of work with the Malki Foundation, as we have at the paper, where the father, Malki, actually looked after her. She had a cerebral palsy sister. She did all of the work. So they were immediately, you know, her absence, her loss, the family have generated so much good stuff in Israel with the foundation. The fact that this woman, I mean, I actually saw it, to see her smirking, she actually laughs. I mean, it feels like a bad episode of Fowder when you're watching it, but you can't believe that you're only getting the one side. In Fowder, at least you get both sides. And it's a one-sided, horrible display of the fact that when these women volunteer to do these things, they seldom have regret.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, we should highlight that it obviously was on the BBC Arabic service, which does not excuse it by any stretch of the imagination. But it is important to stress that it's quite obvious that from that name alone, that it would be quite impossible to offer a balanced view of something as delicate as the situation in the Middle East. Though, of course, we would like to think that across the BBC they would do that. And might I stress, being someone who has worked for the BBC and does occasionally do so, I don't personally find the organisation as a whole in question. I believe, by and large, more often than not, it's certain people who work for the organisation. I want to make that very clear.
No, because I
think that gets lost.
No, I agree. Yeah, no, the BBC gets a lot right. You know, it's got very high standards, which is why when something like this happens, something needs to take place that's just beyond an empty, vacuous sorry. You expect better of the BBC.
We certainly do, and luckily, more often than not, we do get that. But let's have a look now through the rest of the paper. And page 2, Jewish population of Europe has fallen 90% since late 19th century. Possibly not a surprise, but still sounds quite shocking.
Yeah, no, yeah, not a great surprise, as you say, but the numbers are still quite boggling. So those expert number crunchers at the Jewish Policy Research, you know, they're so adept at gazing into their crystal ball and sensing where the demographic winds are blowing. Well, this time they've gone backwards to 140 years ago and discovered that the Jewish population of Europe has fallen 90% since the 18th century. Now, of course, there are some big factors, probably three big ones, the pogroms of the turn of the 20th century and the exodus of Jews from Europe, particularly to America, the Nazis, of course, and then, of course, the State of Israel. So it's quite clear that there aren't going to be that epicenter of Jewish life in Europe the way that there once was. But if you just look at some of the numbers, I mean, what were those 3 million Poles who were Jewish before the war? Probably isn't 30,000 now. Even in the UK, there was about 400, half a million Jews in the UK after the Second World War. And we're down to what, about under 300,000 now. So the trend is clear. I think in future generations, very few Jews will live outside Israel and America.
Well, there's more of that on page 2 of the paper. If we flick back, actually, just to the front page, I should mention that there is a rather striking image, or actually, to be precise, 8 striking images of 8 Jewish celebrities with a line that reads, "Eyes wide shut," and it's because Jewish celebrities are striking a pose for mental health, and that's on page 27. But, Bridget, it's quite extraordinary, sort of, really, the number of people and the names who are putting themselves towards this campaign.
Yeah, it's a campaign for MIND. So just to be clear, it's not just Jewish celebs who've done it. It's, you know, loads of celebs because, you know, just having spoken to Jamie yesterday, in fact, the Jewish mental health charity, the numbers calling them, their switchboard is just, the phones are ringing off the hook. There is a great deal of unhappiness, you know, anxiety, troubled people in our community and way beyond, because what people are facing now with redundancy, worries about health, isolation, has really, really, I mean, we're just, you know, this is just the beginning, unfortunately, of what will only get worse. And these celebs have taken part in the MIND thing, and they're beautiful images. But I think it's now really important that we get behind the mental health charities as a people and support them, because they're really going to have a lot of people who need our help.
Very wise words indeed. Mm. Page 27 for that. Photos include Helena Bonham Carter, Stephen Fry and Matt Lucas, to name but a few. Okay, let's move on to final story we've got time for this week. Page 28. And we are doing everything we can to keep going. And this is to do with the plight of restaurants in Tier 2.
Yeah, this is Louisa Walters, founder of the Restaurant Club, story that she's done this week on the restaurateurs who, obviously, if they don't have any outside space, are reduced to only having families or people who are in your bubble inside their restaurants. And as the clocks go back and the rain falls down, that is going to reduce their, you know, their business by, you know, a lot. And it's really, really tragic, because they've only just come out of lockdown, started up. You know, obviously people are doing what that, you know, they think they drive to a different tier. So if you're in tier 1 and you drive to tier 2 and you know, the policing of it is very difficult. But I know, having booked a restaurant myself, that they are asking you on the phone if you're coming with people in your bubble. The honest, you know, how honest you are is down to you. But this is an enormous hit on the restaurant business, notably those who don't have outside space. So once again, I'm, you know, appealing to the community to get takeaway, support them somehow, because if they can come out on the other side of all of this, we will have a healthier, you know, economic situation. And, you know, a lot of these people we know that own restaurants. So I think they need our support.
It's a very simple premise. Use it or lose it. And I don't really think there's much more that we can add to that. Obviously, that's page 28. We do wish all restaurants all the best as we continue this rather bizarre new way of living. Thank you both very much indeed. That's all we've got time for a look at the paper for this week. Don't forget, though, that you can find the full paper every Thursday. And if you are isolating, you'll find it as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. Editor Richard Ferrer, supplements editor Bridget Grant, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks, Phil.
Shabbat shalom, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, as you've just been hearing in our paper review, the father of a teenage girl who was among 15 people killed in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem condemned the BBC this week for giving the boastful killer a platform. Now, this is, of course, despite issuing a fulsome apology. Well, we can now speak to Arnold Roth, whose daughter Malky was amongst the victims when the attack happened at the Sbarro Pizza restaurant back in 2001. Arnold, I think words are cheap in situations like this. I can't even begin to imagine what you and your family have been through, but all I do know is that I can thank you for being brave enough and kind enough to talk to us about it. I hope you know that it's very much appreciated. Can we start off with, first and foremost, your reaction when you found out that this particular individual had been given airtime?
Pretty negative reaction. The BBC came in on the top of something that I'd been tracking pretty closely, and that is that within Jordan, there was a rather strange encounter in which the woman herself, the murderer, whose name is Ahlam Tamimi, she's a Jordanian living in Jordan, phoned into a talk show on a commercial station and evidently took the two hosts by surprise. They reacted to the surprise of speaking with her by, in a rather obvious subterfuge, cutting her off. This BBC story dealt with the outrage in Jordan at the idea that the murderer, but they didn't call her the murderer, had been silenced. And this was a story about victimhood, her victimhood. She's the victim of the Jordanian narrative, and she's the victim of the BBC story. And the more that time goes by, and it's only been a few days since the BBC account, which was carried by a program on their Arabic service called Trending, the more enraged I get. The way in which the BBC dealt with this is simply beneath contempt.
In the absence of anyone from the BBC, obviously we do have to recognise that they're not here to answer for themselves. I've already read the statement earlier on in our paper review, but I will repeat, just in case anyone did miss it, that following an editorial review, the BBC said that they found that this particular segment was in breach of their editorial guidelines, and they removed the clip from their digital platforms last week, and they also accepted that the segment should not have been shown and apologised for any offence caused. Is it just about apologising for offence? Because I think this runs so much deeper than that. And I'm not even emotionally involved.
Phil, you promised me that we're going to be talking for 3.5 hours, and I'm not sure that it's going to be enough. So allow me to indicate at this, of course, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
we're going to have to do this very briefly. But it isn't a brief subject. It's a deep subject with enormous ramifications for at least two dimensions of being a citizen of the United Kingdom today. The first is, whose business is it that the BBC gets involved in advocacy journalism? There's no question that that's what they did here. The apology doesn't begin to deal with the real issues. It's a nonsense apology. It's a formalistic apology. and allow me to come back to the nature of the apology at the end of these next few seconds, but the advocacy aspect of it is the really disturbing part. At a certain point in this 6 or 7 or 8 minute presentation on the BBC Arabic, they said, and now we turn to Ahlam Tamimi. And then she is there speaking directly into the camera. I don't know any country on earth that takes somebody who is a fugitive, actually in this case, the most wanted female fugitive in the world, and who has a $5 million reward on her head, and says, well, this infringement of your human rights, which by the way is the right to be living with her husband, would you like to tell us how really hideous that is? Now, there's a lot that readers need to unpack in order to make sense of that, and we really don't have the time, so I'll just take two of those issues. The first is that her husband had been expelled forcibly from Jordan just a week earlier by the Zionists. Sorry, not by the Zionists, by the King of Jordan. Why was the husband expelled? Well, no one has had the courage to actually say why, but he's now living in Qatar. And she refuses to go to Qatar for reasons that she explains. So now she's separated from her husband. That's truly tragic, says the father of a child who was murdered in cold blood, along with 14 other people and a 15th who's in a vegetative state. I really feel for the infringed human rights of the woman who at any moment can get on a plane and go and spend the rest of her life in Qatar with her beloved, but chooses not to. Obviously, I'm speaking out of very deep cynicism. I don't know what business the BBC has in giving a platform to a woman like that. But then allow me to be a little bit more generous. The fact is that the BBC have reached out to us on a level and in a way that I'm not going to talk about here because I haven't talked about it to anybody. But I believe that there is some basis for us to talk. The important thing is to say that the contact is made on the basis of we shouldn't have run that show and we shouldn't have issued an apology in the way that we did. And on those two statements, I think we can all agree. As to where this takes us, what was really wrong with the program, I'm not sure that we're ever going to get very far, but we're certainly going to be pushing as hard as we can to help British people understand what it is that's being done with their money, with taxpayers' funds to the tune of almost £300 million that were handed over to the BBC to create, among other things, this program called Trending in 2017, and what it says about the attitude of the British government to the murder of Jewish children by a woman who is now treated as a hero for doing it.
It is baffling. And I speak as somebody, as I mentioned again earlier in this program, I speak as somebody who has worked for the BBC. And as far as I'm aware, I'm still a freelancer on their books. And I wholeheartedly believe that as an institution, the BBC is not anti-Semitic or racist. But I do believe that there are some people who work for it who have major problems with their editorial judgment. And based on whoever was in charge of the editorial judgment for this, I don't know the name of the person, and I'm not really interested because I think it's irrelevant. It boils down to whether or not those individuals are trained properly to recognize what is appropriate to go out on a national broadcaster's platform. Now, it's important to stress that this was on BBC Arabic service, but even so, it is still funded by the BBC. And as far as I'm aware, some of the services, and I really don't know the ins and outs of this for the BBC in terms of their Arabic service, I know that some of their subdivisions are funded elsewhere as well, but I don't know the ins and outs of that, so don't quote me on it. The upshot is, what needs to change, seriously? This might sound like a really obvious question, but what has to change in, let's focus on British media here, because I can't count the number of times that we've heard misreporting and inappropriate reporting, but this has just gone above and beyond. I've never, ever heard anything like this, and please God, never again in my lifetime will I ever hear anything like this. What needs to change?
Well, the first thing is to seize the point that you made correctly, that this went out on BBC Arabic. There's no way that they would have dared to put something like this into the mainstream programming. On the other hand, probably millions of people who happen to be Arabic speakers saw it. And the effect of them seeing it can only be described as the BBC normalizing what the woman stands for. Now, let me quickly add to that. The woman is tremendously popular. She's a genuine hero, an icon, an inspiration. She incites to murder, Constantly. She's been doing it since the day she returned to Jordan in 2011. For the BBC to focus on its Arabic audiences and to convey to them the message that, yes, there is a victim here, it's her. Her rights have been infringed without mentioning what she did. They're not mentioned. The murders aren't mentioned. The children aren't mentioned. My daughter's not mentioned. That she is wanted by the American authorities and by everybody else on earth, that there's an Interpol red notice out against her. Wherever she goes, she has to be picked up by the local police. There's a whole list of things that the BBC didn't say. And here's what they did say. They said there are charges against her that are alleged. This is nonsense. First of all, she was convicted in Israel on her own open confession. Secondly, the United States, which is a very rigorous legal system, wants her on very serious terrorism charges in a federal court in Washington. This didn't get mentioned. In other words, the entire viewpoint of this piece was it's us against them, that is, us Arabs against the Americans, and by implication, the people who fund the Americans, the people who own the movie industry of the Americans and so on. It's us against them. And the only way in which we can keep the noble Ahlam Tamimi, who's standing here in front of the cameras on the screen in our living rooms right now, is to be in total solidarity with her. Now, I could stop at that point. There's nothing else I would really need to say, because you can come up with the fanciest mission statement for the BBC. You can come up with the most rigorous code of conduct. And we all know that the BBC has excellent draftsmen and lawyers who come up with codes of conduct and mission statements. And everybody dropped those documents into the toilet before they started this program about Ahlam Tamimi. There are no apologies capable of being drawn up that quite capture how far the BBC has fallen when it thinks, hold on to these words, when it thinks that nobody is watching. It's just Arabs talking to Arabs. That has enormous implications. And without abandoning the microphone for another few seconds, allow me to just address the last things that you said, Phil, before you handed it over to me. You're not sure how these things are funded. I'll tell you. I've got all the documentation. I found it myself. It's all open source. The Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office of Her Majesty's Government paid £291 million to the BBC in 2017. And the BBC trumpeted this all over the social media in saying, here we have an opportunity to give a voice to these various non-English language populations that we seek to address. But it's not seeking to address, it's British policy. And I don't know if the people in the Foreign Office have even been asked about this, but without any doubt whatever, the trail, the audit trail that leads to the disgraceful incitement to terrorism and normalization of the murder of Jewish children that took place on the BBC on the 8th of October leads back to the Foreign Office. And as much as I want the focus here to be entirely on the BBC, and I walk right away from all the claims that they are anti-Semitic. I think that's a real red herring. Whether they are or they aren't isn't the issue here. But they have totally failed in what they claim to be their mission statement. And if this is British policy, then bring it out in the open. Let's talk about it.
Oh, it's certainly something that you have done for us on this edition of the Jewish News Podcast. And Arnold Roth, words don't often fail me, but I think they have done in this case. And I don't know anyone who would probably feel any differently. I can't thank you enough for highlighting this and for being kind and brave enough to talk about your situation and your reaction to what can only be described as one of the most shocking incidents that I've ever known from the BBC. And I'm very grateful to you for speaking to us on this edition of the Jewish News Podcast.
Phil, I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Thank you. I would like to end by highlighting that, obviously, in the absence of anyone from the BBC here to answer for themselves, obviously, we have read their statement. And if anyone from the BBC wishes to have their right to reply on this programme in any future episodes of the Jewish News Podcast, of course, they are welcome to do so. This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, heartfelt tributes have been paid to Kindertransport refugee Ingrid Wuger, who has died at the age of 96. She was born in Germany in 1924 and was forced to flee her home aged just 15, a few weeks before the outbreak of the Second World War. To look back at her life and to pay a perfectly fitting tribute to her, I'm delighted to say that we can speak to Kirsty Robson, who's Regional Ambassador for Holocaust Educational Trust and based in Glasgow. Kirsty, thank you for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast. I'm very sorry that it's under such circumstances, but could you tell us a little bit, because I know that you knew Ingrid personally, so could you just maybe tell us a bit about her and what she was like as a person?
Ingrid was a fantastic woman with an absolute love for life and an ability to see the good in anybody. You know, like you said, she came to the UK through kinder transport initially, England, and then when her parents were able to join her, they moved initially to West Kilbride, and then when, you know, enemy aliens were no longer allowed to live near the coast, they moved to Glasgow. And she then met her husband Henry, who also came to Scotland through kinder transport, and they ran a very successful catering business. They volunteered throughout their life, and Ingrid was very, very dedicated to ensuring that nobody forgot what happened during the Holocaust and made sure her story lived on in both her community across Scotland and across the UK.
Now, you mentioned her husband, Henry. It only seems fitting to ask whether or not you've been in touch with Henry, who is, thank goodness, still with us, and just how is he in general? He must be, well, one can only begin to imagine.
Well, I have spoken via email with his family. They had 75 very happy years of marriage together, so I'm sure it's a very difficult transition. However, Henry is one of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life, and I'm very proud to call him and to have called Ingrid a friend. And I'm sure he still is dedicated to making sure that what she was passionate about lives on in her community as much as she did.
Let's talk a bit about what she was passionate about. So tell us a bit more about her story. We've established when she came over, but how did she use her experience for the better? Because obviously, you know, it was horrendous for anyone to have to go through what she and other survivors went through. But how did she turn it into good?
Well, through the Holocaust Educational Trust's outreach program, Ingrid, along with Henry, visited, you know, schools, communities, groups, faith groups, to tell people about what happened so that people can bear witness to her testimony. And it gives young people like me — I met Ingrid in 2016 for the first time and then went on to become quite good friends — it gives me a reason to say, you know, I know what happened because Ingrid has told me what happened to her family and how she came here. You know, it's a fantastic thing with the Holocaust Educational Trust providing young people with an opportunity to get to know survivors. It means we're able to take on their stories and tell others and share that story. And Ingrid was very passionate about making sure that people were able to share those stories. And, you know, we are in the unfortunate position where survivors aren't going to be around for, you know, decades more. I'm probably one of the last groups of people who would have heard a survivor in school. I made sure when I was still in high school that I had Henry and Ingrid come in and speak to the younger pupils so that everybody had that opportunity. And I probably will be among the last groups of young people who were able to do that. So it is vital that we redouble our efforts to make sure those stories are told. And organisations like the Holocaust Educational Trust are just fantastic in ensuring that young people can do that. They really gave Ingrid a platform to make sure she was able to pass on the lessons and the stories that she was so passionate about, which for me, she always used to discuss. Race and colour are not something we should be paying attention to. It should be more to do with whether somebody is good or not, whether they are helpful or kind. And that was something she very much instilled in all of us. Anybody who heard her would know that that was her main goal, was to make sure that people looked beyond what they see into whether somebody is just good and kind.
Tell us a little bit about the work that HET are doing in your part of the world, because I think that sometimes we forget that a lot of Jewish life can be quite London-centric or Manchester-focused, but of course there is quite a large Jewish community in Glasgow. And I just wondered sort of what sort of work does go on a daily basis with Holocaust Educational Trust.
Well, like you say, there is a very prominent Jewish community in Glasgow. Outside of my volunteering with HET, I am a communications manager for the Glasgow Jewish Representative Council. So I've seen the impact that Henry and Ingrid had in the Jewish community in Glasgow. But also, you know, the work of HET is so vital. And like you say, so many things do become very London-centric. And they have made a real strides to make sure that people all across the UK, not just, you know, Scotland and England, but Wales and Northern Ireland, are able to access that vital source of education right from the root, these survivor testimonies, and in non-COVID times, making sure that young people have the chance to visit Auschwitz, for example, or they ran their very successful Belsen 75 project where young people were able to visit Bergen-Belsen. So it's a huge benefit to Scottish communities, Scottish young people, that means that we don't have to be in London to get that level of education that some may say is very focused down south. We end up with a very great community that is totally passionate about raising awareness of survivor stories in Scotland, and that can be through organisations like the Scottish Jewish Archive Centre or Gathering the Voices that are based in Glasgow that collect testimony from Scottish survivors. And it is just really exciting to know that there are people all across the UK who are dedicated to sharing the stories of the Holocaust, and that is part and parcel down to the impact that Het has had north of the border.
Now, I've on many occasions, I have spoken to people from Holocaust Educational Trust and, of course, other charities that do very similar and great work. But as time has gone on, the same conversations come up time and time again, where we've spoken about how it's obviously not going to be, and you've alluded to it already, that we're not going to have survivors in our midst for very much longer. Do you ever worry about the impact that stories will have if they're ultimately passed on through secondhand resources, i.e. whether or not they're through some sort of recorded testimony or whether or not they are passed on through relatives of those who are no longer with us? Is it going to have that same impact, do you think?
I think it will. And it's unfortunate that COVID has led to us having to utilise these resources probably sooner than we would have expected necessarily. But, you know, I spoke to survivors over Yom Hashoah who said that it was great because they could see that they didn't have to be in a room full of school children to tell their testimony, but they still knew it was going to be discussed and passed on and talked about. So, you know, we are seeing proof that survivors can be digital just now where needed. And, you know, down the line, I'm hoping that these resources, whether they be recorded or through second generation, third generation, they are still going to be as powerful. Just we need to make sure that just now, while these people are still here, we do speak about them and we do speak with them. And I'm really passionate in making sure that any survivor that wants to discuss their story, whether it be on a small scale, one-to-one, or whether it be, you know, to on a Zoom call with hundreds of people or in front of a room of, you know, young children when it's safe, I'm really passionate to make sure that that can happen. Because as you say, you know, we don't want to get to a stage where these people aren't here to talk about things anymore and we don't have any recollection or recordings of what they want to talk about. And it's our duty as ambassadors to Het and other similar organisations to make sure that, you know, we are providing those opportunities, we are listening, and we will bear witness to what they have talked about.
Just finally, how will you remember Ingrid personally?
I like to think Ingrid played a massive part in me becoming so passionate in Holocaust education and, you know, making sure commemoration happens UK-wide. I vow to continue the work she started in Glasgow and East Renfrewshire in Scotland and make sure that her story and Henry's story and everybody else's is passed on. Ingrid left a legacy of making sure people were able to speak about these things and encouraged, I know on a personal level, encouraged so many others to speak about their stories. I think Ingrid's life was such a benefit to so many, and I count myself as one of those people. Without her, I wouldn't be doing this. And I want to make sure that her name and her story and all the lessons she has spent the last 4 years teaching me and talking to me about will never be forgotten. And that's something I hold exceptionally dear and will stay with me forever. It truly reflects on the theme for Holocaust Memorial Day next year, which is Be the Light in the Darkness. And for me, Ingrid was an incredible light in very dark times. She shared the horrors of her past to make sure myself, my colleagues, my community, my friends, other young people are able to learn. And for that, I will be forever grateful. And I just want to make sure that I continue to do her proud, and I will make sure that her name and her story are never forgotten.
Kirsty Robson, Regional Ambassador for the Holocaust Educational Trust, thank you so much for telling us about the life
thank
and
you.
Work of Ingrid Wooger. This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, The historic city of York is hoping to get its first rabbi since Jews were expelled from England 730 years ago, after a tiny but growing community have begun to raise money for a salary there. Well, now we can speak to one of said founding members, Ben Rich, who joins us on the Jewish News podcast now. Ben, this might sound really infantile of me, but I think this sounds very exciting.
I think it's incredibly exciting. And we set up the community 6 years ago, and it has been incredibly successful. We've had bar mitzvahs, we've had baby namings, we've had weddings, we've sadly had the odd funeral, and we've had lots of Jews by choice. And as a result, there is a really thriving community in York. And the next step is to be able to have a resident rabbi in the city.
Now, if we were to sort of just do the geography a little bit, because I have to tell you, I'm pretty rubbish at geography. So just in case anyone is unsure, York is towards the north of England, towards sort of, should we say, more the middle of the UK. And it's, am I right in thinking it's sort of, it's kind of, if you're looking at a map of the UK, York is sort of up and to the east of Leeds. Is that right?
Absolutely right. If you were to go on the east coast line from London to Edinburgh, we're halfway up the country.
Well, there you go. And perfect.
Just to the right of Leeds.
Much better description than I could give. But then again, I did warn you, geography is not my strong point. I wonder why York, though. I know this might sound really silly, but where do you think the interest between Jews and the city of York first came from? It's now seeing as it's so long after the expulsion.
So obviously, historically, the real, the first time that people really heard about the Jews of York, and it was actually the capital of England at one stage and England's second city, was when there was a pogrom here in 1190, so 100 years before the expulsion. And very sadly, about 150 members of the community lost their lives at Clifford's Tower, which is still a landmark in the city, albeit a different version of Clifford's Tower. So, you know, historically, there's a reference, and indeed, there's peyot and prayers that tend to get said over the High Holy Days around the world that reference the pogrom in York. And so it's had a reputation. But much, much more recently, I mean, this is a beautiful city with two universities, 25,000 students and academics, halfway between London and Edinburgh, but, you know, less than 2 hours from London, with a teaching hospital and a tech park. And it's hardly surprising, therefore, there are lots of Jews here. But because of that history, most of them tended to think they were the only Jew in York. And the number of people I spoke to who told me they were the only Jew in York when we started was staggering.
Now, I know that you have an association with Reform Judaism, though this is a liberal community. We'll get onto that in just a moment, if we may. But the reason why I mention that is because I happen to be a part of the largest known Reform community in Europe, here in London. So I am probably about the furthest away you can get from being involved in a growing and a building a community. I mean, don't get me wrong, obviously, I think we are still expanding, but what I mean is from scratch. And I just wonder what that's like, because I assume that sort of whoever amongst the first of you are in that community, it must feel quite isolated initially.
It does and it doesn't. So when we moved to York, I already knew probably half a dozen Jewish people in the city from one way or another. So there was a core of people, and most of those people were members of the synagogues in Leeds or Harrogate, and in some cases perfectly happy there and not looking for anything in York. What I realized very quickly, though, is if you talked about your Judaism and you wore your Judaism on your sleeve, then very quickly Jews started coming out of the woodwork. One of my favorite stories is watching a busker early on in the center of York and a little child running out to put some money in their hat and doing it very, very cutely and doing a little dance, and her mum going out to collect her, but in that way that, you know, proud parents do, sort of looking round to see that everyone was admiring her child and noticing that she was wearing a mug and dubbed. So I accosted her and I said, you know, are you Jewish? Yes, I'm Jewish. We're thinking of setting up a community in York. Would you be interested? Oh, yes. And she became one of our earliest members.
Love it. How amazing is that? And it's, as you say, it's about the fact that we do live in a country where, by and large, we are able to wear our religion, as you say, on our proverbial sleeve. And it's a shame that more people don't think like that. There's still a very antiquated way of thinking where one has to hide their religion for the sake of almost their security. And it just goes to show, if something like that can happen, how important it is. Now, I mentioned just before that your history, for those who don't know, is that you were quite high up in Reform Judaism, but this is a liberal community. What was the thinking behind that? Was that sort of a vote system? Was it just more people wanted liberal, or did you decide? How did that side of it come about?
So it is a liberal community, and as I say, we've been going for 6 years now. I was, for those who don't know, chief executive of the Movement for Reform Judaism. But my family, the Rich family, are one of the oldest liberal families in Britain. My great-grandfather set up the South London Liberal Synagogue. Danny Rich, my cousin, was till very recently the chief executive of Liberal Judaism as we sought to take over progressive Judaism in this country. And frankly, Danny was very, very supportive of the project initially, and it's my heritage. And so it was the obvious place to start. One of the other co-founders is a woman called Roz Clayton, who was also very involved in liberal Judaism. So it was a very natural thing to do.
Now, I know that you are, as a community, as I mentioned right at the start, trying to raise funds to make this happen, because anyone who knows, a community does not run itself. It does take an element of, well, funds to make that happen. How are the fundraising efforts going? What have you done to date to make that money appear? And what do you still need to achieve?
As I say, we've been going 6 years. And actually, when you say a community doesn't run itself, for the first couple of years, that's exactly what it had to do. We didn't have a membership fee. We just relied on donations and hard work. And we had around 100 members. The difference being that our members show up. Our members have always been very engaged. And so when we introduced a membership fee about 5 years ago, they were happy to start paying, even though they weren't used to paying shul subs. We've carried on doing that and operating that way. Liberal Judaism have provided us with a student rabbi up till now. But it has become more and more apparent over the last couple of years that the next stage involves having a resident rabbi based in the city of York. That's not to support the community as it is now with its, as I say, around 100 members. But if we want to go to the next level, that's what we need. So we started fundraising about a year ago. That was primarily from within the community and with our own contacts. We were trying to raise £75,000 with a view to being able to make a commitment to somebody for 3 years if we're asking them to move themselves and their family here. And I'm really excited to say that we had raised about £45,000 from largely within the community prior to the interest from yourselves and other media about a week and a half ago. And since then, we've raised a further £8,000 from incredibly generous people. So we are over two thirds of the way there, but we still need another £25,000 to be able to make a very firm commitment. So we're showing progress, but not quite there yet if somebody wants to help us.
Just finally, so people can do a search and they can find where they need to go, tell us the name of your community and how they can find out more.
So we're the York Liberal Jewish Community. And our website is jewsinyork.org.uk, jewsinyork.org.uk. And please do check out the website. You can see the donate button. Also, have a look and see what we're doing. You'll see a huge range of activities, weekly services now, adult education, children's education. And one of the great things to come out of this terrible pandemic is, why not drop into one of our services? See what they feel like. We try and be very friendly and everyone is welcome.
Well, I know I said just finally, but I lied actually, because actually that's one thing I should have asked you as well, is do you have a synagogue? And if so, where is it? Are you allowed to tell us for security reasons?
We would certainly tell you if we did. We meet in the Friends Meeting House in the centre of York, and we are very, very grateful to the Quakers for letting us use their building. We've taken a view that if we're going to invest, we want to invest in people rather than bricks at the moment. So many synagogues, particularly small synagogues, have a real struggle simply paying the gas bill, and it takes up a lot of the mental energy of the community to make that happen. We want to invest that mental energy through a rabbi in education, Jewish learning, Jewish study, Jewish prayer, and that's why we've prioritized being able to appoint a rabbi. Of course, if somebody wants to give us a building too, we'll certainly consider it.
Ben Rich.
You don't ask, you don't get.
Well, quite. In the meantime, Ben Rich, one of the founding members of the York Liberal Jewish Community, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, there you have it. That's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. For more information, you can always visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to our guests, Arnold Roth, Kirsty Robson, Ben Rich, and of course our paper team, Richard Ferrer and Bridget Grant. We must also say thank you to Justin Cohen for producing and to Adam Bradley for his work on post-production. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episodes or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you. Email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.